We're going to start off today with a song. Come, come, whoever you are.
Lover unbelieving, ours is no care of and of despair. Come yet again, come whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no care of and of despair.
Across the wall of a world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, the Asian, the Hispanic, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Muslim, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher, they all hear. Speak to humankind today. Come here beside the river. Plant yourself beside the river. Here, root yourself beside the river. I am that tree beside the river which shall not be moved. I'm yours. Your passages have been paid. Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, and men, take it into the palms of your hands. The horizon leans forward. Here, on the pulse of this new day, may you have the grace to look up and look out and into your sister's eyes and into your brother's face and say simply, very simply, with hope, good morning. That, if you didn't recognize it, is a poem by Maya Angelou that she wrote on the occasion of William Jefferson Clinton's inauguration. I do think it's a good morning. I was able to get my cross-country skis out this morning and tool around the neighborhood. Some of you may feel differently, and that's cool. Today, we are going to, in the theme of intention this month, we're going to kind of study an aspect of Martin Luther King Jr. and hopefully maybe kind of realize how intentional he was about life and that maybe some of his work is still unfinished. I'd like to call your attention next to the order of service and the announcements. We, for example, the meditation circle that meets, I think, Sunday afternoons, and Women's Coffee and the Men's Group. And I was remiss, maybe we should have put in there that today, I believe right after the service, we're going to be discussing the OWL religious education program, and parents, or at least a parent, is encouraged to attend. And the other thing I'd be remiss in announcing is that last Sunday, the congregation was unanimous in voting another 3 years for John Alou as our minister. Thank you. Okay, so the next thing on the list. Okay, sure. So we're going to break from tradition a little bit a couple of times in the service today, including usually we receive the joys and concerns from the community verbally, but there's been some feedback that maybe, like myself, sometimes, you know, we're maybe timid and, you know, don't want to share our joys and concerns verbally, so we've been collecting them, and so John Alou's actually going to read them and give us an opportunity later to do that.
So if you have a joy or concern, there are cards out in the narthex, and Katie has some here. If you write it down and put it in the offering plate, I'll read them after that.
Okay. Nick, would you like to come up and light the chalice for us? If you're new to visiting us for the first time or new to you, Unitarian Universalism, we typically will kind of initiate the service by lighting a chalice, and the symbol is that, pick another one. The symbol is that we kind of, by doing that, we commemorate or we actually covenant to worship together. And as we have done this, thanks, Nick, as we do this, maybe we should have a look at the flame. And I'd like to read a small excerpt from the Tao as we have a look at this flame from the chalice. Can you coax your mind from its wandering? Can you cleanse your inner vision until you see nothing but light? Can you step back from your own mind and thus understand all things? We light the flame of this chalice today in memory of Martin Luther King, Jr. That we might better understand his intentions. Okay. We're going to have the opening hymn today, which is number 149 in your order of service, and we're actually going to be accompanied by the UFM singers with us, too.
Thank you. nobody's calling my name. Hush, hush, somebody's calling my name. Oh, my Lord, oh, my Lord, what shall I do?
Now we're going, it's time for the story for all ages, which Sandy's going to read. Story today, which is about Martin Luther King and the dream.
Good morning. Did I get it? I think this really needs no introduction. This is a story. This is an excerpt of a story, and it's called I Have a Dream. And who's the author? Martin Luther King actually wrote this book. Junior, excuse me. He wrote this book because it's his part of his speech, his famous I Have a Dream speech. It's not the whole thing. Say that again.
So it isn't about his whole life?
No, it's just an excerpt of a particular speech that's kind of famous. Yeah. And it's something that you might want to think about as the words come out. And it's also something that as you read, is really hard not to have the canter and the, you know, I hear it in my head as I go. So my apologies if it comes out. I say to you today, my friends, that even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day, on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing, land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside, let freedom ring." And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill in Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing, in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." Yeah. That's the short version.
Glory in the hearts of you.
On the second Sunday of every month, we have a portion titled Helping Hands, where we give to a worthy project. And today's Helping Hands guest is Linda Teener from UFM Project Excel. Would you like to come up and share something with us?
Good morning, everyone. I'm so happy to be here among friends. I know so many of you already to talk about UFM and Project Excel. Before I talk about Project Excel, I wanted to, for those few of you who don't know what UFM is, to explain who we are. UFM Community Learning Center is a 50-year-old community education program that was started by a group of K-State students and faculty back in the mid to late 1960s. As a way to begin to share community, to be able to share ideas and learn from each other in a neutral setting. Very quickly, UFM developed into its current model, which is putting together a schedule of classes and activities for the community. Our current catalog, which is the first that celebrates 50 years of programming to our community, I have some in the back if you'd like to have it, one to take home with you, follows the same format that we used 50 years ago. We go to the community every semester looking for people who'd like to share ideas with others in the community. We organize that and then offer that. We've been averaging about 250 classes a semester for the last number of years. Our first catalog had 7 classes, and we had, I think, 47 people attend. Now we have thousands who participate in our programs at UFM. In addition to the classes that we put together, we also do a lot of community outreach because that's part of our mission as well. And so we offer a number of programs to the community. We have a teen mentoring program. We have the oldest community garden in Kansas, and we're going to be signing up soon if you want a garden. It's not a good day today, but we're going to start signing up next week for new gardeners for our garden plots. We have 280 plots available in Manhattan to garden. We work with KU in a program to offer programming for older adults. We offer the Lou Douglas Lecture Series at K-State. Our next lecture is actually going to be on February 22nd, and it's going to be a different format. Peter Bratt, who is an independent filmmaker, will be talking about, and we will be showing his film Dolores, which is a documentary about Dolores Huerta, who was one of the founding members of the United Farm Workers Movement. The following week, we'll be doing another one on La Misión, which is about gay rights and the development of that through the years. Peter does a lot of very interesting work. I hope that you can come, if you can, to see Dolores. It will be on February 22nd in the K-State Alumni Center at 7 p.m. There's the first ad. The second ad I want to give before I get into what we're talking about today is next Thursday, the 25th of January, we'll be offering the second in our series of Talk 20 MHK programs. This is a program that kind of follows a TED Talk sort of format. You have 20 slides, 20 seconds a slide, to share something that you are interested in to the community. It'll be at 7 o'clock in the public library, who is also celebrating 50 years of being in that building. So it's kind of a fun joint activity we're doing. And we will have a number of programs. I can't tell you what they all will be. I know we have one on beekeeping. We have one on finding beauty in the landscape. We have one on finding beauty in everyday objects. And that is all I can think of at the moment. There are a total of 6 of them that will be held that evening. Please come out. If you can't join us, we also will be doing it Facebook Live. So if you go to TriUFM's Facebook Live Facebook page, you'll find it live streaming that way, and it'll be available afterwards on our website. But what I'm here to talk to you about today is Project Excel, which is another one of the outreach programs that UFM has been doing. We've been doing this for 8 years now. It's a program that provides some enrichment education for special needs adults in the community, some of whom have no other options for getting out, socializing, and learning than our program at the moment. We cooperate with Big Lakes in this. We also cooperate with the Twin Valley Developmental Center, which is up in Marysville. We have about 60 to 70 students each semester who come and participate with us. Some of them drive as far as 60 miles away to come and participate on a Saturday morning. Our classes start at 9 a.m. We try to provide a variety of educational programs and experiences for them that provides them enrichment, some fun, and some life skills training. Generally, we have 5 classes. They can choose one for a 4-week period, and then they switch to another class after that. We've done things like money management. We do arts and hobbies. Right now, the favorite class is yoga and dance. That one maxes out immediately. We do geography. We do personal enrichment kinds of things, life skills, self-care. We've done microwave cooking. We do functional reading, so we might read a cookbook and then cook it in the microwave. We've done pet care classes. We've done a lot of acting and drama sorts of things. Our students have a terrific time. Probably the greatest stress we have is finding instructors to help us teach the classes. So if you know anyone who would like to give 5 Saturday mornings in a row to teach a class for us, we would love to visit with you about doing that. You will get more out of it than even the students do. It's so enriching to go to Excel on Saturday mornings and see the students. They arrive bright and eager. They want to participate. They want to learn. And in an environment where sometimes you go complaining about having to get up and go to class and have to read this assignment, it's such a change to see the kinds of things that they do. So UFM coordinates this for them and provides these kind of programs as best we can offer to the community. We hold the classes on the K-State campus, and we partner with the K-State Union, who offers the space to us at no charge, and the College of Education, who provides students for us to help with the classes. So we have generally 10 to 15 K-State students who come on Saturday mornings and work with the students, serving as aides, helping in the classrooms, and in some cases we even recruit them to teach classes for us, so they're getting some extra experience along the way as well. We do four sessions a year, so we do two in the fall, two in the spring. And then in May, after the classes are over, we do a graduation ceremony each year for the students that they look forward to immensely. We do it in a special place. We have done it in the Little Theater at the Union. We've done it in Town Hall at Leadership Studies. Last year, we had a quartet who came and played for them ahead of time. Then each class gets up and talks about what they learned or demonstrates something that they've learned in their classes. They get certificates. We had a valedictorian last year who gave a speech on behalf of the rest of the students that were there. And then we do refreshments and greet the families and the students that are there. The highlight of that activity is generally Willie Wildcat coming to help serve refreshments, to help greet, and spend some time with our students. We almost had a crisis last year because we had to do it in Town Hall rather than in the Union because of the renovations that were going on there, and Willie didn't get the word. So here we are. All the students are going around, "Where's Willie? Where's Willie? Where's Willie?" Here comes Willie, costume and all, riding a green apple bike down the road. So it was quite a special experience for our students there. So we appreciate the support that you give us for Project XL. I do a lot of grant writing and fundraising to try to keep this program alive, because that's the main ways that we are able to offer this service to our community. Anybody have any quick questions for me? No questions. No questions. John and Luce has not one question. So, with that, thank you all for your support. Pick up UFM catalog. I'll be around afterwards if you want to visit about special activities. Thank you.
So, the offertory will go to the UFM, right?
Project.
Thank you.
We are a community here, and as a community, we grow and evolve, and we do things differently sometimes, and we've asked you to submit joys and concerns and put them in the basket. Did anybody have one they didn't put in? Okay, very good. We're very joyful this week, it looks like. We have a joy from Kathleen Oldfather that she is happy to have joined the 60s Club this week. Onward and upward. And this year, one of the board's goals has been to strive for having pride in space. And so our new sign has arrived to show our pride, and we are joyful about that. Who noticed the new sign this morning? Well, you know, it looks a lot like the old sign, except it's not rotting. But thank you very much to Mark Mayfield for taking the lead on this. And we are so appreciative of our community. And we have a joy from a new person who says that they are quite enjoying this so far, that their best friend suggested it, and they're glad they came. So we are very joyful this morning. That's good.
I think at this point I was supposed to maybe share a personal story in the theme of being intentional. And I guess the story that came to mind, consistent with this theme today and Martin Luther King Jr., was that I met my wife. We both went to graduate school in Baltimore, and the school was in the inner city, which is a very dangerous and poor place. And let me back up for a minute. So I think Sandy last week was talking about how she was raised in the UU tradition, and I wasn't, but I, even though my parents were divorced and my sister and I were, you know, raised by my mom, who put herself through college and went to Cornell, and I think she did instill some pretty good UU-ish values in me, and hopefully I'm doing that with my family. But so the story goes that in the inner city of Baltimore, in the hospital and in the School of Public Health where I was, they stationed guards, uniformed guards that, you had to have a badge to get into the building. And often these guards were staffed from folks that lived within the community. And so, you know, a typical lab rat that I was, you tend to be, probably in graduate school in general, you keep odd hours. And so I would come in, you know, late at night sometimes or in the morning time sometimes, and I'd be the only one in the building maybe. And I would speak to the guards and chat with them. And pretty much, you know, kind of eventually they came to know who I was. And so I think this is actually the year before I met Belle, my wife, and my dad comes, and he comes to visit from New York, and as usual, I'm late, and I'm up on the top floor of the lab, you know, taking some time point and keeping my father waiting, as we all do. And so my dad starts chatting with the guard at the booth in front of the building while he's waiting for me. And you know, they're chatting, and I'm way late, probably by, you know, 10 minutes at this point. And the guard says, "You must be Mr. Roberts' father." And my dad was, like, kind of taken aback, and he was like, oh, yeah, you know, we have the facial resemblance, right? And the guard says, "No, He's just the only one that ever talks to us. So, yeah. I don't think we need to say anything more about that, but I do think we've made some progress since then, but I don't think we're done. So, you know, in trying to think about what to say to this beloved community and learned community, that story came to mind. And recently, I was really lucky. K-State sent me to a conference, and the last afternoon, I got to walk on the beach. And I don't know about you guys, but when you walk on the beach, you tend to reflect a little bit. And I'm walking along, and I'm thinking, you know, wow, this is amazing, you know. And sorry. I got to thinking that, you know, sure, you know, I went to graduate school, I wanted to cure cancer, and, you know, every day I go into the lab and I roll up my sleeves, but, you know, maybe one day, as I said the other day, we might be able to control cancer a little bit better, but it's a tough fight. And anyways, as I was walking along the beach, I started to realize that, you know, geez, I'm 50 years old now, more than that, and I'm probably not going to be able to walk on the beach for another 50 years. So, you know, what else can I do? What else can I do? And like all of you, you know, I try to live a good UU intentional life. We could list things. But as I was walking along, I thought to myself, okay, 365 days in a year, maybe I'll be lucky, you know, and I can go another 30 years. And what if I just did one good thing every day, just one good thing? By the end of the year, I'd have 365 things, you know, that would be cool. And I thought today, you know, my good thing was going to be getting up here and doing this. And actually, I took my cross-country skis out, and I'm skiing through the neighborhood, and my neighbor's shoveling his snow. Never talked to that guy in my life. But I already did a good thing, because I stopped and offered him kind words and encouragement. So I don't know what else to say about that, just to be... but I was looking through our UU pocketbook last night, trying to figure out how I could close this to people that know more about being UU and living it than I do. And this kind of resonated, so I'm going to read this. This is from, maybe Jean-Luc can tell us about the history of this book. I don't know it. But we do not require our members to subscribe to a particular theology or set of affirmations in order to join our congregations. Instead, we encourage individuals to garner insights from all the world's great faiths, as well as from Shakespeare and from science, from feminism and from feelings. We invite people to explore their spirituality in a responsible way. We ask the Unitarian Universalists to cherish the earth, to free the oppressed, and to be grateful for life's blessings. Out of this combination and reflection and experience, each one of us shapes a personal faith. For Unitarian Universalists, the individual is the ultimate source of religious authority. Thank you.
Our hymn is number 104, When Israel Was in Egypt Land. Please stand as you're willing and able. Let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand. Let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt. Tell, O Ago this year that Martin Luther King was assassinated. Do y'all remember where he was when he was assassinated? He was in Memphis. He was in Memphis, and what he was doing? Yes, sanitation workers. He was standing with laborers, sanitation workers, garbage collectors, trying to collectively improve their working and living conditions. Two men, Echo Cole and Robert Walker, had been killed doing their job, flattened in a malfunctioning, broken-down garbage truck. Similar deaths had taken place a few years earlier, and what did the leaders, the city of Memphis, do? Nothing. Nothing. Some jobs we might expect deaths from. Coal miners, police officers, dangerous jobs, firemen. There's no excuse for people collecting garbage to die. That's criminal negligence. The sanitation workers went out on strike in response, asking not only for safer working conditions, but also for fairer wages and union recognition. 700 workers unanimously called for a strike. Now, conditions have to be pretty bleak to get that kind of support. Not only did they contend with dangerous, broken-down old trucks, they didn't get retired overtime pay and earned less than $2 an hour, so low that many qualified for food stamps and public housing. They could be fired without warning. But does any of this sound familiar? We still see some of these conditions, don't we? Now, although the sanitation workers were predominantly black, this was not, strictly speaking, a civil rights issue. They weren't talking about voting rights or racial discrimination in public accommodation. This was a bread-and-butter issue. Safe work, fairly compensated, with a right to organize. Nevertheless, the black community did come out in force in support. The local NAACP backed the strike. Ministers formed the Community of the Move for Equality, COME, C-O-M-E, to apply Dr. King's nonviolent resistance methods to highlight the situation. Even white people, especially high school and college students, joined the resistance. Tommy Powell, the white head of the Memphis Labor Council, unlike many other labor leaders, supported the strike. Now, the Memphis City Council, to their credit, was ready to do the right thing. They voted to recognize the union and offer a wage increase. They were overruled by the mayor, Henry Loeb, who insisted that he alone had the right to recognize the union. Now, Henry Loeb kind of looks like a villain in this, but we have to be cautious. It's so easy to name a single villain like Henry Loeb or George Wallace or Adolf Hitler or whoever, what that may disguise is the more subtle evil that's done, the masses standing behind those leaders who may not be screaming at workers, at the strikers, go back to work, but who accept that the mayor's right. He's only doing his job. He's in charge. He may be harsh, but firmness is needed. Like the newspapers in Memphis that openly sided with Loeb and the police who carried out his orders and eventually shot 16-year-old Larry Payne during a demonstration. And that wasn't the only violent encounter. Police released tear gas inside a church where protesters gathered and clubbed people trying to breathe as they lay on the floor. It doesn't require violence to support villainy, though. What about the white workers brought in to replace the black strikers? Not to mention the national labor leaders, the union leaders who first discouraged a strike. 700 voters, workers had voted unanimously to strike. And then urged the strikers not to make so much out of the racism and to focus on the economic pieces. But guess what? Racism made it possible to keep these sanitation workers in such an untenable situation. The issues, as they so are, often are, racism and economic equality, were distinct but entangled. Anyway, it takes more than one leader up front holding folks down. It takes a whole complex system, which is part of why all these issues end up so related. And that's what Dr. King recognized when he came to Memphis. On the 18th of March in 1968, he spoke to a crowd there of 25,000 saying, "You are demonstrating that we can stick together. You are demonstrating that we are all tied in a single garment of destiny, and that if one black person suffers, if one black person is down, we are all down." Now, we can't interpret King's response to the Memphis sanitation workers' strike in isolation from his broader work. Dr. King had found a shift necessary in how he was engaging. In May of 1967, he spoke to the Southern Christian Leadership Council staff, saying, "I think it is necessary to realize that we have moved from an era of civil rights to the era of human rights, when we see that there must be a radical redistribution of economic and political power. Then we see that for the last 12 years, we've been in a reform movement, that after Selma and the Voting Rights Bill, we moved into a new era, which must be an era of revolution. In short, we have moved into an era where we're called upon to raise certain basic questions about the whole society." Dr. King saw the fight of the Memphis sanitation workers as part of this era of human rights. And we're talking about intention this month. And this is an important part of intention. How do our small strategies fit with our larger aims? When my knowledge of Dr. King's work and trajectory was more shallow, I didn't understand really what he was doing working for labor rights with sanitation workers in Memphis. It seemed like an aside, a diversion from his civil rights work. Well, however, he was in the midst of planning the Poor People's Campaign. He had named three issues: racial injustice, economic injustice, and the war economy as what needed to be addressed. And frequently he spoke of the connections among those issues. Racial justice fueled economic injustice. The war economy prevented spending to support economic justice. Economic injustice was used as a wedge to divide people on the issues of race. And we'll come to those issues specifically in a moment. First, I have to acknowledge that the basic questions about the whole society, and particularly about those issues, were never more apt than they are today. And the same lens and values that King brings to the whole society still apply today. Now, does this miss some stuff? Yes. at least a couple of issues. Today, we'd have to add environmental issues, including climate change. And it's deeply connected to the others. Where are dirty factories and noisy highways and hazardous waste landfills sited? Where? Poor neighborhoods, often near people of color. And the travesty of water poisoning in Flint demonstrated environmental racism. And then the Standing Rock water protectors showed us the connection between racism and environmentalism, how the pipeline plan was changed to protect the water of the people of Bismarck, North Dakota, while it wasn't changed to protect the water of Native Americans. And that's all tied in with economic considerations, of course. We're prevented from making the changes we need to in order to resist or reverse climate change because of what it would do to the economy, especially particular parts of the economy, like the oil industry, whose power exceeds that of humble voters. The power of economic interests cannot be overstated. Dr. King's life came a bit too early to recognize and address the concerns of environmentalism to his other concerns. Successors like Van Jones have led the way on this edition. Dr. King also didn't address the disparity between the sexes. And some have complained that the civil rights movement of the 60s ran too much on the work of women without them having either the credit or the power. Now, no one is perfect. Everyone's a product of their own time and place, but I think we could raise some questions about Dr. King's attitudes toward women. Yet, there have always been people who understood the connections between racism and patriarchy. Even in the 19th century, particularly black women like Sojourner Truth and the Unitarian Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, but also black men like Frederick Douglass and white women like Amelia Bloom, they recognize that both racism and patriarchy maintain hierarchies that prevent the full functioning of people, whether it's deprivation of bodily freedom or limiting them to particular jobs, particular societal roles, or even a general sense that some folks are just better than others and deserve more. Yet in this country, through the last couple centuries, as African Americans and women both fought for their rights, their freedom from the particular constraints that they suffered under, we've not always recognized our interconnections. In the 19th century, suffragist groups literally split over the question of the black vote. And stories are told of black activist and journalist Ida B. Wells sneaking into a parade for suffrage when the group she led had been asked to march separately at the end of the parade. And those tensions persisted when women of color often felt dismissed during the second wave of feminism. Only with careful intention and reflection can we resist these inconsistencies in our thinking and shortcomings and realize the real interconnections that exist amongst our issues. And today I see deeper understanding of the connections. We can't forget that it was black women, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tormetti, who founded the Black Lives Matter Network, and its influences come not only from the civil rights movement, but also from the feminist and LGBTQ movements. They define themselves as deliberately intersectional and inclusive, and that is intentional. All of this is saying that we can face the temptation to focus so fully on particular issues that we lose the perspective that Dr. King saw in his, particularly in his later life, in connecting the dots, finding the ways that racism, economic injustice, war, climate change, all of these things that reinforce one another. It's too small a world to fight one another over our small issues and keep our eyes off the myriad ways that unfair distribution of power, influence, and wealth keep us separated rather than united. So let's look at the three key core issues that Dr. King named as he moved to addressing human rights more than civil rights alone. Economic injustice was, of course, central to the Memphis campaign. As I said, he was organizing this Poor People's Campaign. He had said this, he had this to say about it in his final Sunday sermon before his death. "We're coming to Washington in a Poor People's Campaign. Yes, we're going to bring the tired, the poor, the huddled masses. We're coming to demand that the government address itself to the problem of poverty. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty nor the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. We are coming to ask America to be true to the huge promissory note that is signed years ago, and we're coming to engage in dramatic nonviolent action to call attention to the gulf between promise and fulfillment to make the invisible visible." He proposed an economic bill of rights as a step to lift the load of poverty, including $30 billion annual appropriation for a real war on poverty, congressional passage of full employment and guaranteed income legislation and guaranteed annual wage. I mean, we're not even talking about stuff like this anymore. And construction of 500,000 low-cost housing units per year. We're not even talking about this stuff now. What we're pushing for just looks insignificant. So more from King. He said, "We're called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring." And despite his assassination, Dr. King's Poor People's Campaign did come to Washington, D.C. As a child, I lived in the suburbs of D.C. and remember the muddy encampment on the Mall. 9 caravans converged from different places in the U.S., including Appalachia, and then there was an Indian caravan, among others. There was sadness to the effort, though. Drudgery instead of the energy that might have been stirred. Without King to cement the unity, the uprising was not what it could have been. Who knows how the world might have been different? Today, we have to recognize that the face of poverty is children and women. According to the Brookings Institute, almost 15% of our population is poor, and more than a third of the poor are children. More women than men are poor in every racial category and every age category of adults. Only 5% of poor people are able-bodied, unemployed, working age, non-students, and non-caregivers. So almost all the people who are poor have good reasons that they can't do a lot different. As someone said at the Kansas State of the State rally on Wednesday, "Why do we have so much compassion for the wealthy and so much contempt for the poor?" Now, we've seen great progress in one area of poverty in the last 100 years. Where? Seniors. Why? Social Security. It's not perfect. We still have too many poor seniors, but the rate of poverty there has tumbled precipitously. The solution to poverty, as Dr. King taught us, is radical redistribution of wealth. And he didn't mean reducing taxes on those who have the most. Further, he recognized that the war economy, the expenditures dedicated to the Vietnam War, had strained the U.S. economy. And as he said, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. That's a big claim, spiritual death. So war and militarism inflict damage beyond the killing and maiming of soldiers and innocents caught in the crossfire. They disconnect us from our highest values and create moral harm to all responsible. We engage in violence while touting our innocence. Now, I could do a whole sermon on that, but That's not the topic for today. So finally, racism. We may have moved into a new era on this one. During President Obama's tenure, people used his election as evidence that the racist legacy of slavery had ended. Well, this was nothing new. People had proclaimed the end of racism with the desegregation of schools and passage of voter rights protection. So I think we have one thing to thank our current president for. He has made crystal clear the deep roots of white supremacy in our country, along with reaffirming the strains of xenophobia that have flourished since Europeans set foot on this continent. No one can now deny that racism exerts power in this land, that it wields power. Now, when people name the racism they observe, it's harder to dismiss it as playing the race card. Our president has said out loud words that live on in many hearts and minds. And again, there's much I could say about racism, but what I want to focus on in our final minutes is to return to the first Poor People's Campaign and to remind you that a new Poor People's Campaign is in the works. Reverend William Barber, one of its architects, declared the need this way. We declare that the moral public concerns of our faith traditions are how our society treats the poor, women, LGBTQ people, children, workers, immigrants, communities of color, and the sick, the people whom Jesus calls the least of these. Our moral traditions point to equal protection under the law, the desire for peace within and among nations, the dignity of all people, and the responsibility to care for our common home. So, it can work to gather together and press for what's right for all of us. Remember the Memphis sanitation workers' strike? After Dr. King's death, the number of protesters grew and the national attention kept down the violence from the local government. All that attention brought negotiators from the federal government and an ultimate, if costly, win, recognition of the union and increased pay. Dr. King's vision of bringing people from all across the nation, from all walks of life, from all races and identities, has expanded as we pay more attention to LGBTQ people and women and the connections of all of this to the land that we rely on for life. And still, the vision that remains of thinking and acting intentionally by connecting the ways we are affected, seeing the big picture, we can still attribute to the last couple years of Dr. King's work, years that are too often forgotten as the focus remains just on his dream from 1964. He had other work. So, to get our check. Are we ready to help everyone get their check? Okay, the promise has been long delayed, but if we're to praise Martin Luther King Jr. without hypocrisy, then we must sign on to his project. Reverend Barber writes, in the church where I was raised, the old folks used to sing a song with the words, "Hold on just a little while longer. Every little thing is going to be all right." Holding on to that faith, moral movements have never known ahead of time how long we have to struggle before we reach higher ground. But we've always known that when we got there, every little thing's going to be all right. So we hold on to faith and take care of one another as we travel on this way. And lest we get distracted by the snares and cares of this world, we say to one another, forward together, not one step back. Forward together, not one step back. Forward together, not one step back. Thank you. We're going to sing hymn number 6, just as long as I have breath. Our closing words come from UU Minister Reese Williams, remembering our spiritual, courageous ancestors who forsook oppression with security to gain freedom with opportunity. May we go forth to master ourselves by accepting duty and responsibility, by showing balance in our judgments, and by having breadth of vision in our deliberations. May we be exemplars of that spirit, moving forward with conviction and commitment, with unity and without uniformity, with companionship and love, to serve the truth that sets us free. Amen.